This is Victoria, producer for The Felon File, a podcast on law enforcement history, issues, and incidents in the Appalachian Mountains of the United States and beyond. Listen to in 39 countries around the world. Scott Lunsford hosts The Felon File. Scott is a retired American police sergeant. Today's Shade of Blue story is about a man of the cloth. His story sounds more like a horror film or novel than a chapter from actual history. Unfortunately, it is a true story. Background and intro music through purpleplanet.com.
Welcome back to Felon File, podcast where we look at crime and punishment, the good guys, the bad guys, the not so good, good guys, not so bad, bad guys, and a little bit of everything in between. We focus a lot on the Appalachian Mountains, as well as some more modern and update incidents that have occurred. Thank you, Victoria, for running the control board for us. We do appreciate it. Our podcast, or Shade of Blue story, as we like to call them, is the result of a rabbit hole. Falling down a rabbit hole while looking and doing some research on another incident, I came across this information and found it very interesting, very unusual, very strange, and I knew you guys would like it. Originally, I was looking at a missing person, young lady, girl that had disappeared in Kentucky. And one of the suspects in her disappearance and murder was a priest that was going to the church where she had, who was working at the church she had disappeared in. That got my curiosity up and I started looking at the priest. And that opened up a whole can of weirdness. The priest's name was Hans Schmidt. He was born in Bavaria, in Germany, to a Protestant father and a Catholic mother. Records and research reveal that both sides of Hans's family had a very long history of mental issues, and it looks like genetically the kid didn't have much of a chance. Now, growing up, Hans was submitted to beatings by his father and had to watch as his dad also beat up on his mother. The mental health situations, the abuse, an overall lack of understanding of mental health issues at the time, and exposure to powerful religious influences were all factors in his growing up in late 1800s. Now, while he was young, these issues may have led to some overall sexual promiscuity, experimentation with different sexual activities, and he also had a fascination with drinking blood, or as the mental health guys call it, human hematopography.
That's pronounced human hematophagy, Scott.
He was also had a side hobby of dismembering animals. Family stories of Hans growing up there in Bavaria reference a report of him beheading two of his parents' geese and keeping the severed heads in his pockets and carrying them around with him. Hans was also a frequent visitor to the village butcher and the slaughterhouse. He was fascinated with observing the death and dismemberment of animals there. Now, when I'm able to go and watch his pastime, he would dismember animals and drink their blood there at his house. His other obsessions, but one that was socially acceptable, was his fascination with the Roman Catholic Church and their rituals. Growing up, he would pretend to be a priest in make-believe games and with games with other children. He was also able to, in his mind, justify a fascination with his sexual experimentation in Catholic celibacy. His interest in the Catholic Church directed Hans to a seminary study and a desire to become a priest. While at seminary, though, he discovered another hobby that came in handy for him a little bit later. But he made use of it later in life as well as the time as he's in seminary. Now, seminary was a very tough religious school, and you had a lot to learn and a lot of different things to keep in mind, and you had a lot of ritual to memorize. Some students found they just couldn't cut it. They could not handle the educational experience. But still wanting to not disappoint their families back home, they turned to Schmidt. Schmidt soon discovered he had a skill at forging documents, and in particular, diplomas for failing students at the seminary. At least, they got something to take home to mom and dad. Eventually, this came back on him, though. He was arrested by the Bavarian police for counterfeiting, and in 1905, was charged with forging the documents for his failing friend students there at the seminary. Now, the prosecutor for the government wanted to make an example of Hans, and they planned to send him to prison. But sometimes money talks and the bad guy walks, as we all know. Schmidt's father hired one of those high-priced German lawyers, or the equivalent thereof, who arranged for the charges to be dropped under the grounds that, you guessed it, there was a mental defect with Hans. Now, many in his hometowns who had known Hans growing up throughout his childhood and felt that his moral and mental fitness issues were just a bit of a touch and go for him, too much so to ever complete seminar and become a Catholic priest. But at 25 years old, Schmidt told his family and others that he had been ordained by Bishop Manns there in Germany on December 23rd of 1904. Now, that's the time that Schmidt entered the priesthood. His church assignments were in several different German towns, places that he soon became well known in, and was known to have molested a couple of the altar boys in those locations, had affairs with several women of his congregation, and had a nasty habit of consorting with known ladies of the evening. Meanwhile, Schmidt's creative way of saying Mass in his unusual sermons, and I'd love to have sat in on one of those, led his parishioners and fellow priests to complain about him to the Monsignor and the bishop. Now, with these issues and others coming to light, Schmidt knew no other European church assignment would probably be happening. In fact, the church just wanted him to go away, disappear. Well, that's just what Schmidt did. He just went away. He did so by immigrating to the United States in 1909. Now, during an investigation later in New York City and talking to the mental health professionals of the day, what they referred to as alienists, as they were known back then, he told his interviewers that the bishop had ordained me alone, that he didn't like to speak about it, but his real ordination took place the night before, that Saint Elizabeth had descended upon him while he was at prayer, and he was ordained by her at this time. Quote, I was praying at my bedside when she approached me and said, I ordain you to the priesthood. Now, there was a light radiating from her appearance, but I told no one. I decided to keep it to myself. They would make fun of me, I knew. They always made fun of me for these things, you think? They always expected others to do as they do. God speaks to different people in different ways. Keep that in mind. Now, his first church in the United States, his first assignment was to St. John's Roman Catholic Church in Louisville, Kentucky. This is the location a little girl disappeared from while he was assigned there. And later, he was a principal suspect in that girl's death. Although someone else ended up being arrested, jailed and convicted for the crime, many thought that Schmidt was at least somehow directly or indirectly involved with her death. There was also a disagreement between Schmidt and the head priest there. Schmidt was soon transferred to St. Boniface Church in New York City. Now, in New York City in 1912, when Schmidt was there, when he met Anna Amuller. Anna was the housekeeper at the rectory of the church. She was from Hungary and had immigrated to the United States about 2 years earlier. Schmidt told her that God had spoken to him, ordering him to love Anna. At first, she refused his advances, but you know, it's hard to ignore when the big guy says something or tells you to do something. I don't know if that was the case, but eventually, Schmidt was able to harass and annoy her enough that she finally gave in to his advances. Now, this resulted in the two having a secret affair, the church housekeeper and the priest. Now, there's a soap opera for you. But she wasn't the only one Schmidt had singled out. In December of 1912, Schmidt also started a homosexual relationship with a New York City dentist by the name of Ernest Moret. Now, getting back into his old hobbies of home documentation making and the like, the priest and the dentist operated a counterfeiting ring together. And it also appears that later it was found out that the dentist wasn't actually a dentist. He had manufactured his degrees based on the work of a much older man in Germany. So basically, the counterfeiting dentist himself was a counterfeit. Schmidt and Anna continued their relationship, and they ended up getting married in a private ceremony, mostly to keep Anna happy. Now, following the old adage, if you want something done right, you have to do it yourself. So Schmidt, he officiated the wedding himself. Combining his other skills, he also put together a marriage certificate and other forged documents showing that they were legally married together. He told Anna that he was going to leave the priesthood for her. Now back to our mental health issues. During a romantic encounter with Anna on the high altar of St. Joseph's Church in Harlem, New York, Schmidt said he received God's commands to sacrifice Anna. He claimed that the order was told repeatedly to him by God. Well, when he told this to Anna, she just called him crazy and let it go at that. Very soon after that, Anna found out she was pregnant and told Schmidt. Now, on the night of September 2nd of 1913, Hans Schmidt returned to the apartment the two had been renting together as a married couple. Schmidt cut Anna's throat while she slept and drank her blood and raped her as she bled to death. He dismembered her body, very similar to the way he had watched farm animals in Germany when he grew up there be cut up in small sections and dismembered. He collected the pieces, putting them into pillowcases. Then he went for a ferry ride across the Hudson River, carrying these pillowcases with him. Now, when he was out on the water and nobody was looking, he chucked the body parts over the side of the ship. After disposing of all the body parts, he returned to his church and offered Mass. Got back there just in time. He administered Holy Communion at the St. Joseph Church just like he would have done on any other day. One of the things he hadn't counted on was individual body parts tend to float unless they're weighted down. Well, some of them were weighted down with rocks and stones, but you got to remember he's carrying the cut up body of a young lady and has her divided up into these pillowcases that he has some rocks in. That's a lot of weight to be carrying, and a lot of weight to try not to look suspicious with. But apparently he was able to do it. But it wasn't long before that body parts started to float up. Individual body parts tend to float unless they're weighted down, especially in fresh water, where that water will carry them downstream and eventually to the shore. Not to mention the Hudson River was a regular mode of transportation at that time for a lot of people. And it wasn't long before pieces of Anna's torso had washed up on Cliffside Park to be found by some children. They also showed up at Weehawken, New Jersey, Hudson County, New York, and a few other places. Now, these locations all were investigated, and all the parts were gathered up that they could, and they were reviewed. Investigators did locate a price tag attached to one of the pillowcases used to carry and wrap up parts of the body. They were able to trace these items back to Newark, New Jersey, at a factory there that made the pillowcases. Detectives went there and they were told that those items were sold exclusively to a Manhattan furniture dealer and store owner, George Saks. You know, the guy from Saks Fifth Avenue? Well, actually, I don't know if it's the same guy, but anyway. At this point, New York City Police now got involved, and their detective division, especially Manhattan Chief of Detective Joseph Farrat. Now, at the furniture store, Farrat discovered that their sales records showed that a bed spring, a mattress, some pillows, and pillowcases had been sold to one A. Van Dyke. The items were delivered to a third-story apartment on Bradhurst Avenue. Going to this location, the building manager told detectives that a married couple actually lived in that apartment. The husband was described as having a very strong German accent. He went by the name of Schmidt, according to the manager. Surveillance of the apartment turned up really nothing. Nobody came and nobody left. So the head of the detective division ordered his detectives to do a search. Well, they entered the apartment, and once inside, it was obvious that something had happened. The floor had been recently scrubbed, and a large amount of dried blood was found on the walls where they had attempted to be cleaned off, but they weren't able to be. A large blood-stained knife and an axe was located on a shelf in the kitchen. The name A. Van Dyke was found sewn into several pieces of men's clothing there. A revolver was also discovered in the apartment. An important fact in the opinion of the police was that the revolver belonged to the good dentist, Dr. Moret. A duplicate of it was found in his dentist's office, as a matter of fact. Both of the guns made by the same company in Germany. The police were also satisfied that the weapon from the dentist's office had been discharged recently. However, the dentist said, or the fake dentist said, that it couldn't be true that nobody had been near his guns or had shot them. Also located in the apartment was a collection of letters, some of them in German and some of them in English. They were addressed to Hans Schmidt. Many of the letters were from women in Germany, but most of them were from Anna. The return address showing 428 East 7th Street, her old place of residency. Now, Inspector Farrat and his detectives went to this address, where they were told that Anna had moved out. She'd obtained employment as a housekeeper at the local Catholic church. The new information sent Farrat and the detectives to this particular church, where they interviewed the senior pastor, John Braun. He notified the detective team that Anna, yes, had been his housekeeper. Still, she had recently moved on to another church for employment, this church being St. Joseph Church in Harlem. Now, of course, the priest was asked if he knew Hans Schmidt or this Van Dyke character. He advised that he didn't know Van Dyke, but that Hans Schmidt had been one of his priests at St. Boniface Church, but had been reassigned recently to St. Joseph's. Hot on the new trail, Inspector Ferrat and his detective went immediately to St. Joseph's rectory, getting there about 1:30 in the morning. Pounding on the door long and hard enough to wake up somebody, they finally got the attention of Senior Pastor Daniel Quinn, who let them in, and then when they told who they were looking for, went and brought Schmidt to them. Now, when confronted by the inspector and the detectives, Schmidt broke down. He admitted, "I killed her. I killed her because I loved her." Schmidt then described the murder and the disembowelment in major detail. He did this with his fellow priests watching and listening to the interrogation at the time. While they looked on in an unbelieving horror, their fellow priest was arrested and jailed. Now, of course, after the arrest, the Archdiocese of New York announced officially to the media that Schmidt's church credentials had been suspended indefinitely. He was no longer considered or to be considered a priest with the Catholic Church. At one point, there was some doubt that the man charged with the murder of Anna was actually Hans Schmidt, the priest from Germany. A few people in Germany who inquiries were made with said that the man known to them as Hans Schmidt could not have been the man charged with the murder. There's no way that he would have done this. This was dispelled after a while by letters sent to Germany with photographs of the man that was under arrest that were sent to the parents and relatives of Schmidt. After looking at them, they concurred that, yes, this is Hans. The police in some of the German cities where Schmidt was well known, they doubted that he was a slayer as well. And they felt that the same way until photos were also sent to them that confirmed the man's identity, as far as they were concerned, leaving no doubt in their minds and in New York Police Department's mind of who they had. Of course, Schmidt was put on trial. And he pled not guilty because of insanity. His dad had apparently bought him some new lawyers, some of the American ones this time, and defense attorneys used the former priest's admission of bisexuality, blood drinking, his enjoyment of animal mutilation, and claims of hearing voices to prove their client's statement of mind that he wasn't quite all there. Evidence was also presented that the mental illness ran in Schmidt's family. The defense team brought a psychologist, again, they referred to them as an alias, Smith Eli Jeffrey, who pointed out that Schmidt's family tree showed up to 60 near or distant relatives who displayed signs of mental instability. And they put all of this up for everyone to see, and the newspapers loved it. Arguing along with the defense that Schmidt should be spared the death penalty because he too was quite insane, just like his relatives. The state, though, they took up a different perspective. They brought their own mental health experts in. They had examined Schmidt during the investigation and before the trial. And on the other hand, despite the defendant's allegations about hearing voices telling him to sacrifice Annie, they concluded that Friar Schmidt, the priest, was pretty much utterly sane. Just a little on the unusual side, I guess you could say. With experts on both sides presenting opposite points of view, the jury couldn't make up its mind. And in December of 1913, it was determined it was a hung jury. But the state put him back into court again in 2 weeks. Now, using the first trial as a practice run, I guess, and learning from that experience, the New York City Prosecution Office knew how to handle the case now and introduced new testimony. It appears that In April of 1913, well before the defendant said he was given the command from God to sacrifice Anna, Friar Schmidt had convinced a fellow German immigrant, a Bertha Zeck, to pose as Anna and buy a $5,000 life insurance policy in her name. The policy listed Schmidt as the sole beneficiary. Zeck testified to this personally in court. Now, the dentist, his forgery partner, and not a real dentist guy, he also testified, saying, "I have known Schmidt only since December, and most of the time we met, we talked about history and sometimes very little else, except for maybe some philosophy. Schmidt always seemed good-natured and harmless to me until the middle of August. Then he began to talk constantly about religion. Schmidt confided in me that he would have the means to build his own church dedicated to St. Elizabeth." Still, the dentist didn't think that remark was that unusual, because, goodness, they were making their own money. "The next time I met him, he said Schmidt spoke about Jesus and said it would be a good idea to be crucified just like Jesus had been." Well, William Flynn of the Secret Service testified that the dentist had been arrested on federal charges and that the two men, Moret and Schmidt, were in an organized plan to turn out counterfeit money. And this had been substantiated by a counterfeiting plant found in an apartment the two of them had rented. Moret, though, said he knew nothing about this and didn't know nothing about counterfeiting and didn't know anything about the priest's counterfeiting plans. After a three-hour deliberation, though, February 5th, 1914, the jury found Schmidt guilty of first-degree murder. The former man in the cloth was given the death penalty. The newspapers quoted Schmidt as saying, "I'm satisfied with the verdict. I would rather die today than tomorrow." Well, he was sent to Sing Sing prison to await that. Of course, the defense attorneys began the appeals process and were able to postpone the execution for about a year while the case went through the system. Doing another newspaper article in December of 1914, Schmidt admitted that he had faked all his insanity issues during the trial. At this time, though, he also accused the dentist and his business partner in the counterfeiting business, with whom he had a homosexual affair with, of accidentally killing Anna during a botched abortion, claiming he allowed the police to capture him and look at him for the murder or death rather than the good doctor because he wanted to cover for his gentleman lover. The allegation didn't do any good. Moret and Bertha Zeck's statements to the press and law enforcement didn't help him at all in getting a new trial. On February 18, 1916, 899 days from September 2, 1913, when Schmidt murdered Anna, Schmidt entered the Sing Sing prison death chamber at 5:50 in the morning. Before setting down for the last time of his life, Schmidt said, quote, "I want to say one word before I go. I beg forgiveness of all I have offended or searched or scandalized, and I forgive all who have offended me." Then, taking a seat in the state of New York's electric chair, and right before the switch was thrown, Schmidt, his voice somewhat muffled by the death hood, said loudly, "My last words is to say goodbye to my dear old mother." And that's when they shocked him. The first jolt of electricity was initiated, and about two minutes after he finally had taken his seat and sat down, two additional shocks were given, and after an observation period of the prisoner, the state of New York's doctor pronounced Hans Schmidt dead at 5:58 a.m. A reporter for the Albany Times would write a description of the event in one of his articles, stating, His last night on earth, he spent proclaiming his innocence and declaring that he had made peace with God. The guards had expected a scene from him when he was to be executed, but his action surprised them. He was the coolest man in the death chamber. He almost domineered those who assisted in putting him to death. The Schmidt family had originally intended to have his body shipped back to Germany, but this was just 14 months before the United States would enter World War I. Because of the already in progress war in Europe, the idea was deemed to be impossible to get him back there. Sing Sing Prison's Roman Catholic chaplain, Friar William Cashin, arranged for a burial in New York State. At the request of Schmidt's family in Germany, the location of his grave was kept secret and only marked with an unwritten stone. Now, besides the murder he was convicted of, detectives had also located the counterfeiting workshop apartment. Schmidt was also suspected in as many as four other homicides. A woman named Helen Green left New York City heading to Chicago the month before Anna's death. She was an acquaintance of the priest. She never arrived, and it's unknown what had happened. Schmidt was also suspected of the death of two children. The owner of the apartment complex where he was living said that she sometimes brought to him a five-year-old boy from outside who told her that he lived with him. Schmidt claimed the boy was his son. There was no trace of the child ever located. And when the apartment owner asked the boy's name once, he told the lady that it was August Van Dyke, the same name that he used sometimes as an AKA. Schmidt became an alternative suspect in the murder of Alma Keeler, the young lady whose body was buried in the basement of St. John's Church in Louisville, Kentucky, where he had once worked. The body had been burned, but authorities suspected the killer had tried to dismember her. The janitor of the church, Joseph Wendling, was convicted and sentenced to life in prison for the murder based on circumstantial evidence and some bloody items found at his house. Upon the request of the young girl's uncle, Wendling was actually pardoned later and deported to his home country of France in 1935, where he was allegedly welcomed as a hero and a victim of evil American persecution. Yeah, remember that. We'll talk about that in another podcast, but that's another shade of blue story. After the media dug deeper into Schmidt's past, they also found evidence of another girl murdered in Germany. Now, the German police never got to investigate Schmidt before he was executed in the United States, and he left the country before they had actually developed him as a suspect in that homicide. And the case technically remains unsolved even today. Friar Hans Schmidt, the priest, lived for only 35 years, but he left an incredible trace in the history of crime in the United States, as well as Europe. As we can see from his story, sometimes you got to be careful on who you trust. Hans Schmidt became the only clergyman so far sentenced to death by electrocution in the United States. Well, that's our Shade of Blue story for this week. Sure to come back in about 2 weeks for another one. We'll have it ready for you and online for you to listen to. You can check out our website, scottlunsfordauthor.com or felonfile.com for more information on us, and also some links to some of our stuff and some of our other podcasts and some of our books that are available. Also, if you got the opportunity, remember, it's a good idea to stand up and do something good for somebody if you ever have the chance or the opportunity presents itself. It's really the right thing to do, and if more of us did that, the world might not be as crazy, if you'll pardon the expression, as it used to be. But in the meantime, Be safe and be secure in what you do, and we'll talk to you again later. Victoria, I'm flipping the switch on the control panel and sending things back to you. We appreciate all y'all for listening. Bye, y'all.
This has been The Felon File, a discussion on law enforcement, history, issues, and incidents in the Appalachian Mountains and other parts of the world. For more information, you can go to felonfile.com or scottlunsfordauthor.com. Here you can find links to Scott and Numb books and other information. You can also email us at felonfile@gmail.com. There are also t-shirts and mugs available. You can also buy us a cup of coffee, or help purchase some of the research material and expenses it takes to do Felon File. Click on the coffee image on the webpage to do so. This is Victoria, your producer. Thank you for listening. Have a good one.